In our, I feel like I need to take a pause after talking about Tongans and switch Chris gears. Okay, now we're going to talk about how being sad helps make you happy. We're doing this teaching series on joy and good joy, pure joy, joy that comes from the Lord. And one of the things we agreed on during our first week in this joy series is that if there is a joy out there that is worth having, it has to be a joy that exists even in the midst of very harsh, very sad, sorrowful circumstances. Because there are a lot of harsh circumstances in the world, a lot of sorrowful circumstances in the world, and we're most interested in a joy that can exist in spite of those, independent of those. And tonight I'm going to talk about a joy that exists because there are hard circumstances in the world. I'm going to talk not just about, you know, sadness in the midst of joy, but the way that being sad can actually help make you joyful. That's the idea. And the scripture that I want to use is the Lazarus story. Do you guys know the Lazarus story? You know, those of you who went through Sunday school. What's the Lazarus story about? Somebody just explain it to me really quickly. Go ahead, Daniel. Jesus raised him from the dead, right? So this is what we think about when we think about this character, Lazarus. Even if you don't spend a lot of time hanging around the church, you probably know the story. Lazarus was a friend of Jesus. He got sick and he died when Jesus wasn't in town. Jesus actually delayed a little bit to make sure that Lazarus died before he came to town. It was really weird. And then Jesus shows up and raises Lazarus from the dead. He comes hopping out of the tomb, all dressed up in his grave clothes like a mummy. And that's what the story of Lazarus is about, right? It's about resurrection, right? I don't think so. Of course not. I'm a troublemaker. I really think that the story of Lazarus is about sorrow and its place in the midst of good things like resurrection and joy and love and things like that. I get bothered when I read the Lazarus story because right in the middle of it, there's this curious little passage. It's a long story, but the curious passage I'm talking about, you'll find in your program. You can look there, or it'll be on the big screen behind me. And Jesus has come to town, and he's having interactions with Lazarus's sisters, who are, of course, in mourning because their brother has died. He talks to one sister named Martha, and then he talks to the next sister, Mary. And Jesus and Mary are very close friends. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. In fact, we know that Mary has just heard that Jesus is in town and is calling for her. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Because Jesus was a miracle worker and he was known for healing the sick. "Lord, if you had only come in time, we wouldn't be crying over Lazarus's death right now and I wouldn't feel the loss." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Jesus was troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. And then the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" In other words, if he loved Lazarus so much, why didn't he hurry here and save him from death? Jesus, what strikes me about this passage is that Jesus was deeply moved at the spiritual level, deeply moved in spirit. I mean, really bothered is what that says. And troubled. He was downcast, hurt. And then he wept. You know, not just cried, not just shed a few tears, but wept. The word is quite strong. Why? Why did Jesus react like that? Right? He knew the resurrection was coming. He knew that he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead. He essentially said as much a few paragraphs earlier in the story. He knew how the story was going to end, that he was going to do the miracle and everything was going to be all right. And yet he takes the opportunity to be troubled. Something's bothering him. He's hurt and he weeps. He weeps hard. And the final question of the text was from the Jews who had gathered there. Why didn't Jesus come and heal him? Which I think is a good question. You know, why did Jesus allow all of this suffering to happen? And I think the conclusion to be made is that Jesus must have placed some value, not just on the resurrection miracle that was set up in this whole story, but also on the sorrow that was part of the story. Right? Jesus could have come to town earlier, the story makes clear, and just heal him of the sickness, you know, glory to God, yay, hand clapping, and there wouldn't have been much grief involved. Maybe a little bit of worry as he got sick, but, you know, there would have been, you know, not mourning. He could have spared them that. And having come to town and seen everyone cry and weep, he could have just said, hey, don't worry about it, okay? It's gonna be all right. But he didn't say that. He actually embraced the mourning there for a while, right? He was deeply moved in his spirit and wept. We would say he got heartbroken first before he did anything. And the response was, see how he loved him? There was something about that that showed a great deal of love. Jesus kind of embraced the sorrow of the situation before he did anything. He could have just kind of shined on the mourning that was happening, but he respected it and he joined in it. And my question is, why would he do such a thing? Why would he honor sorrow in this fashion? Why was it important to him that weeping take place? It's very curious to me, because I'm not a great fan of sorrow and weeping naturally. I kind of avoid it, and I think most of us do. If you look at all the books that are out there, the self-help books that are about mourning and sorrow, most of them are about how to get through it without getting hurt. And Jesus seemed to have a different attitude. He went out of his way to experience it and to experience it deeply and to express it, and that makes me very curious. It tells me that there's something about this that's at the heart of the story. I'm fond of saying, you've probably heard me say it before, that Christians should be the happiest and the saddest people on earth. The happiest and the saddest people. We should be the happiest for all the reasons that we've been talking about in recent weeks. Because we're happiest because the power of God. We should be the most loving. We should be people that move freely in love and in selflessness. And if you've been sitting in on the weeks on this series, you know that love and selflessness lead to joy. Freedom from self and concern and love for others, that's what leads to true joy. We should be the most fearless people, which I think helps us be happy. We should be the most future-looking people, the most optimistic, and all of these things we've talked about in recent weeks. We should be the saddest people, though, because we have the most compassion. We should not be sad for selfish reasons, but there's still plenty to be sad about. If you care about people, you know, you care when people get hurt. If you really love people a lot, if you are a great lover of people, a lot of people, then you will have more occasion to be heartbroken. And Christians are supposed to love everyone in the world. And right now, there are a lot of people in the world suffering, and therefore, we should be sadder than the average human being. We should be happy, the happiest people on earth and the saddest. And in this sense, I have to suggest that sadness is actually a virtue because it comes along with love, right? Love is certainly a virtue. It's like the chief virtue. No one would argue that. If you love well, if you have compassion for a lot of people, you will be heartbroken more often than otherwise. And so you have to say that kind of sadness is a good sign, right? It's a sign of love health. So in that sense, I argue that sadness is a virtue, which is a weird thing to argue, but it is a sign of caring. And implicit in what I've said so far is the idea that you can be happy and sad at the same time. Do you think that's true? Can you be happy and sad at the same time? Because a lot of people think that happiness and sadness exist on opposite ends of the same line, right? You're either sad over here, or you're happy over here, or you're somewhere in the middle. But I'm arguing you can be happy and sad at the same time, which means that, you know, they exist on different lines, different continua. You can be more or less happy and more or less sad. And I think the goal is to be maximally happy and maximally sad at the same time. Is that like totally counterintuitive so far? Is anybody offended yet? Just keep going. You'll suspend judgment for now. Right? I think the people who are most likely to be offended so far are the people who are actually going through a sad and sorrowful time. Right? Because it might sound to you as if I'm saying, hey, just be happy, which is not it. I am far too great a respecter of sorrow to say anything like that. It's a big question for me. It's been a big question, one I've thought about a lot. And in fact, it was the most influential question of all of my years spent in depression, about 6 or 7 years. And it's the one I had to answer. Can you be happy and sad at the same time? Reason being, I saw no hope for escaping my sadness. So I wanted to know if I could be happy in the midst of it. I don't want to talk about that question directly tonight, though. Instead, I want to take a look at this. Maybe it's a more surprising idea that being sad might actually help make you happy. That's what I want to talk about. If it does, if being sad does help make you joyful, then even if being loving and compassionate breaks your heart, you'll be more joyful and stronger for it. That's kind of the argument I want to make tonight. And the sadness, the sorrow I'm talking about, I just want it said, I'm talking about pure sorrow, you know, good kind of sorrow. If you're feeling really sorrow right now because you did not get that raise at work, you know, the one that you didn't really need, but that you wanted, if that's really bummed you out, okay, well, then you deserve to be miserable, right? Because that's just kind of selfish and shallow. I'm not talking about sadness that comes from that sort of frustration and disappointment. We're talking about the sorrow that comes from a broken heart. You know, if someone close to you is hurting and therefore you are sad, if you've had a mournful loss in your life and therefore you're sad, okay, that's what I'm talking about. And that sort of sorrow that comes from love and compassion and caring, the sorrow that flows from virtue. That's the sort of thing that I'm talking about. Wanted to make that clear. You might be willing to trade anything to remove the cause of sadness that comes from loving someone. And if someone close to you is hurting right now, and I say, hey, well, that sorrow that you carry will help make you happy. That can sound like I'm being really glib, that I'm being really sort of cavalier about the sorrow that you're having. But I don't intend to be. When I say that sort of mournful sadness is ultimately good for you, ultimately makes you happy, I'm not trying to cheer you up. Right? I'm not saying, hey, so you're mourning over a lost loved one. Cheer up, it's going to make you happy in the end. Right? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you're mourning over the loss of a loved one, good can come out of it. It's much more that sort of spirit that I'm trying to share. And I'm not trying to cheer you up. I'm trying to convince you that God works good in it anyway. It can actually bring good from loss. And I think that tells you something about the heart of God. I get my news through the CNN webpage on most days. And so just randomly today, I checked the CNN webpage and just to see if there was any true mournful stories on the front page. And this is the one I got today. It's from the conflict in the Middle East, the current fighting that's happening between Israel and Lebanon, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And it's a first-person sort of essay by this guy named Cal Perry, who's a reporter over there for CNN. This is how it goes, at least the first part of it. The last time I sat down to write something, it was about the cost of war. As I looked ahead to the coming days, the last words I wrote were, "Who will die?" Today I found out. Standing in front of this 8-year-old boy lying in a hospital bed, the conflict in the Middle East and the cost of war seem endless and suffocating. The boy's pain cannot possibly be imagined as he shakes uncontrollably in and out of shock. This 8-year-old boy has blood coming from his eyes. His name is Mahmoud Mansour, and he is horribly burned. In the hospital bed next to him is his 8-month-old sister, Maria, also burned. Screaming at the top of her lungs is the children's mother, Nuadir Mansour, who is standing over the baby and looking at her son and probably thinking of her dead husband. And the smell of burned flesh is overwhelming. This story for the Mansour family started out as a typical one, probably one that most of us have experienced. They had simply gone on a family vacation to some lovely sunny beaches in southern Lebanon. The 6 of them, like thousands of others, were fleeing the fighting, trying to get north, waving white flags, when an Israeli bomb or missile slammed into their car, and the father, Mohammed Mansour, was killed instantly. His children were all wounded, and his wife, who is now crying over two of the wounded children, was in the best physical condition, but as would be the case for any mother, her life in many ways ended the minute the car exploded into flames. The other two Mansour children, Ahmad, 15, and Ali, 13, are in surgery. Doctors can't tell me if they will make it. They walk away, their heads shaking. Optimism is not a word that breathes truth in this place. There are more than enough stories like this in the hospitals across Lebanon. And then it goes on, just to describe more and more of the carnage that's happening there. Somehow it hit home to this reporter when he saw a little child and a baby suffering with burn wounds in the hospital, probably a hospital that doesn't have a lot of the latest care or pain medications, things like that. So you can't be glib and cavalier about that kind of suffering. You read about it every day if it's there for you to read. All of our teaching so far on joy has been predicated on the idea that being selfless and loving is the path to being joyful. What I'm arguing is that appreciating sorrow like this and mourning over situations like this helps you be loving and selfless. That's really the idea. How does being sad help you be happy? It helps you be happy by making you loving and selfless. And those are the things that lead to joy in the end. That's what I'm talking about. I can break it down a little bit if you're still with me. Sadness helps make you happy by, and I have sort of three things for your consideration. When you are sad, for unselfish reasons, you see things unselfishly. And this is something that probably most of you will appreciate. When you are mourning over someone close to you, when you're thinking about stories like the Mansour family in southern Lebanon, it's kind of hard for you to be self-obsessed, isn't it? Right? If someone close to you is hurting, and you are hurting as a result, then you're not going to worry about that raise, are you? You're not going to worry about that extra 5 pounds that you're carrying around the midsection at that point, right? You are not going to be self-obsessed. You're not going to be thinking about yourself. True sorrow, deep sorrow, has the quality of getting you out of yourself. And that's a gift when it happens, right? If you've experienced true sorrow like that, it puts things in perspective. And that's something that I hear a lot. I do a lot of healing ministry around the church. I get called to an awful lot of hospital rooms and stuff like that. And one comment I almost always hear in group settings and hospitals is, wow, that really puts things in perspective, which is kind of a code phrase we have for, I'm not worried about shallow things anymore. I'm not worried about selfish things anymore. Right? It gets you beyond yourself and actually empowers you to think about others, at least for a while. Even people who are not very well practiced at being unselfish in a time of mourning will get it just for a little while. And I think it stands to reason that if you are cultivating a mournful life, if you go out of your way to like read the headlines and to allow yourself to hurt about stories from southern Lebanon, then you are drilling yourself to get away from yourself. That's a quality that true sorrow brings. It helps you escape thinking about yourself. It helps you escape self-obsession for a while. And that can be a very useful thing. Secondly, true sorrow, when you are in the grip of it, it makes you look for good joy, for godly joy. It helps you, it intuitively makes you look for good, real joy. Have you ever experienced this? Have you ever gone to a funeral about someone who is much loved, and after the funeral, seeing the loved ones, the family gather around pictures of the departed or family albums or something like that, and as they go through the albums and they see that person doing, you know, happy things or loving things, they get smiles on their faces, and there's sort of that loving happiness at funerals. You know what I'm talking about? You have experienced that? People do that instinctively, and I like it, because what they're doing is reviewing ways in which there was love, right, in the life and in their relationships with the departed. They're instinctively saying, we're really, really sad. Can there be any joy in the midst of this? Ah, yes. We love this person, and this person loved us, and that will make them happy. People do that at every funeral, every wake, I should say, that you go to, right? That too is a gift, because that kind of joy that comes from love, selflessness, is true joy, right? Nothing can take you away from that. Those people at the funeral, when they're doing that, have realized instinctively that the joy that comes from love is independent of circumstances. Not even death can take it away. So joy points to points to joy and love. And that's really helpful, because oftentimes it's hard for us to remember that unless we get a little shot of sorrow in our life. And thirdly, joy, I think, has a way of making us look for faith. Sadness has a way of making us look for faith. Most of the calls I get from non-believers in my office come to me because there has been a great sorrow in the life of that non-believer. They're calling me because one of their loved ones is in the hospital and they want help. Or they're calling me because they've just lost a loved one and they need me to explain God in the midst of this. There's something about sorrow that drives people toward faith in God, or at least helps them search for it, right? Which is good news if there is a God worth finding, right? And of course, you know, I think there is, and that's what I say. If you're having a very happy life, a very successful life, and there is no sorrow in it, there's no mourning in it, then there's really not much reason for you to look for something beyond the world. Not much reason for you to look for a God. Look for hope. If you are having a mournful life, instinctively you look for some escape from a world that now looks dismal to you. I participate in a lot of weddings. I participate in some funerals. I get many more evangelistic conversations at funerals. And it stands to reason. The first funeral I did after I moved to town was for a young kid from Kona who had died of cancer, and I had gotten to befriend him. He had come to know the Lord in the midst of his suffering in his final days, and just a good kid. Wasn't able to heal him, but really came to love and appreciate him and his family, and they invited me over to Kona to do his funeral after he passed away, and the entire town came out. You know, just one of those things. Everybody knew the family, hundreds of people there, and I was invited to give a few remarks at the funeral. And what I talked about was how I saw God in this fellow's dying days, and a way this fellow approached his death with courage and with fighting spirit, and that honored the Lord and sort of honored the values that this kid had held. He was a Marine, brave and tough guy, and just tried to bring the spirit of the Lord to that place. And then I had to leave to catch my plane, and in the 100 yards between where the funeral took place on the beach and where my car was parked, I got into 50 or 60 evangelistic conversations. Afterwards, I was mobbed because I dared to be happy at a funeral, because I dared to speak about love and courage and honoring God. Before I got to my car, I was invited to take over the pastorate of a church. I was offered the chaplaincy of a local academic academy. I was invited to 6 dinners. And I think someone was trying to get a date with me until I saw my ring. There's something about sorrow that opens us up to hearing a message about hope in God. If you're having a sorrowful time, you're yearning for faith. You want to trust that there is a good God. And that makes you willing to hear a message about a good God. So, in conclusion, because sorrow brings all those joyful benefits, I would say be sad and be happy, which doesn't make for a good bumper sticker. unless you realize that there's a connection between being sad and being happy. Jesus embraced it, right? He knew the story with Lazarus was going to end happily. But I think because he wanted it to end in full happiness, he wanted the full scope of happiness, he took some time to be sad before he concluded the happy story. I think that's what he was doing in the Lazarus story. He was probably coming to town thinking, well, this is going to be great. I'm going to resurrect my buddy, and everyone's going to be happy. And he got to town, and there was sadness there. And he was wise enough to pause and mourn, to let the full effect of the sorrow and the mourning go through him, so that when the joy came around, it would be that much greater. It would have expanded that much. I think that's what he was doing. Weird navigation of the heart. I'm not sure I'm expressing it well, but that seemed to be what he was doing. I want to finish on one final note, and it might not be of interest to anyone but me, and I'm not sure I can express the idea well, but here it is. Unless you find joy in sadness, you will short-circuit the sadness that you're feeling. And I want to say this for those of you who are respecters of sadness, who realize in your spirit that when you are mourning, you really should do it well. If you want to mourn well, if you want to be sad well in life, if you're that kind of person, if you understand what I'm talking about, then I'm going to counsel you. If you don't find joy in the midst of your sadness, you will never experience mourning as deep as you should. That's what I'm saying. When I read the story of the Mansour family, I will either feel love for them, feel selflessness toward them, and the joy that that love brings, or I will look away from that story. I will choose not to read it beyond the headline. Right? Imagine that I were there on scene in that Lebanese hospital room. If I could not walk into that room and cup the face of that burned little boy in my hands and say, you know, I love you, little boy. You are a joy to me. I enjoy that you are living. You bring joy to me. If I could not say that, then I would not mourn his suffering as I should. You understand what I'm saying? Unless I'm happy at that moment, I will not be fully sad. Unless I'm happy to have him at that moment, I will not be fully sad for him. You understand? Unless you are enjoying him, you will not mourn him. Does that make sense? Yeah? I'll have to say, there's a profound connection between joy and sadness, right? I'm afraid that there's a Christianity out there that sort of paints this truth. Christians should just be giggly all the time, right? Christians are people who are resistant to grief. And I think that's absurd. Not even Jesus was resistant to grief. He was a great respecter and participant in it, even on occasions during which you'd think he might sidestep it when he had no reason to participate in it. He did, right? We are not just kind of dancey, happy, giggly, Pollyanna-type people. That's not our calling. Our calling is to have the full range of heart experiences, to be very joyful beyond all reckoning, and to be very sad beyond all reckoning, right? We become high and deep people. That's really what we're after, until such a time when there is no more cause for mourning. And that's a time that the Bible tells us about. Not in great detail, but it does promise it. Pure sadness leads to love and joy, and love and joy leads to deeper sadness, and deeper sadness leads to greater joy. You see how it works? That's kind of weird, but that's the point. Does this tell you something about God's heart? I don't think about it. I could not articulate fully what it tells me about God's heart, but it says that he's willing to love us even if it hurts. He will love us more because it hurts him. He wants you to be happy, but he's a great respecter of your sadness and will actually weep with you for the sake of making you more joyful. I mean, God does not shy away from your experience, and you should experience life fully before God. Going to work out. This is an intimate sort of being we're talking about. A great respecter of everything that you're going through, both the highs and the lows. And both are important to him because both lead to love and joy. the same sort of place. That's the heart of God in some fashion, worth meditating on and thinking about. To believe anything I've said tonight requires that you have faith in a loving and wise God. It requires that you think that God is out there. Otherwise, the world seems like a really hopeless place to me. That's kind of where I sit. That's all I got to say on that subject. Important to me. If you are here tonight and you are joyful, God bless you. That's a godly emotion. If you are here tonight and you are sorrowful, God bless you. That's a deep and godly emotion too. And there is power and love in both of those things. And God will meet you there. We like to end every nightlife by doing some prayer ministry. Glenn, can you bring